This is a closed-circuit feed not for broadcast. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with Tipper Gore. As co-founder of the Parents Music Resource Center, Gore wants records with sexually explicit lyrics to carry warning labels. Also, I'll talk with South African novelist Nadine Gordimer. Her latest book, A Sport of Nature, follows a white South African woman as her country ends apartheid and turns to majority rule. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Don't Let Me Down, David Bowie's latest album, and our film critic Stephen Schiff says these days everyone's a movie critic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me now on Fresh Air is Tipper Gore. She's co-founder of the Parents Music Resource Center, whose aim is to alert parents to music that the group thinks could be harmful to children and teenagers. The group is pressuring the music industry to put warning labels on records with sexually explicit or violent lyrics. The focus of her efforts has been heavy metal and punk groups, whose lyrics, she argues, glamorize suicide, rape, and sadomasochism. But she has also criticized mainstream acts like Prince and Madonna for the provocative nature of their music and stage shows. Gore's concerns were fully aired at highly publicized hearings on Capitol Hill 2 years ago that pitted her against such disparate musicians as Frank Zappa and John Denver. Tipper Gore has written a new book. It's titled Raising PG Kids in an X-Rated Society. It takes on not only the record industry, but also music videos and violent TV shows. Tipper Gore's husband is Tennessee Senator Albert Gore, who recently declared his candidacy for the Democratic presidential nomination. Tipper Gore, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to be here.
How did you first become aware of sexually explicit lyrics in music?
Because my children tuned me in. I grew up with rock music in the 60s. I like rock music. I like all kinds of music. And I was a bit surprised to find out how graphically some of the content has changed in recent years. My oldest daughter is now 13. When she was 11, we went together and bought Prince's Purple Rain album, along with 14 million other people. I think he's a musical genius. I had liked a lot of the songs I'd heard on the radio, and she was very interested in him. I didn't know that he'd had a history of sexually explicit albums, which in fact he had at the time. I just knew he was the new pop idol, and she wanted his songs. So we bought it. And our first indication was when we played on the family stereo a song called Darling Nikki, which did describe a girl masturbating in a hotel lobby. Now, that tuned me into how things had changed.
I want to just play the beginning of that record so our listeners could get a sense of what you were listening to. So this is Prince.
I guess you could say she was a sex fiend. I met her in a hotel lobby, masturbating with a magazine. She said, how'd you like to waste some time? And I could not resist when I saw little Nikki grind.
So that's an example of the record that you were listening to. And there's the word masturbating. Masturbating with a magazine is the line in it.
Well, masturbating with a magazine, watching Little Nikki grind, it goes on to more graphic descriptions. I mean, I just thought that it was a bit much for my 11-year-old. What really made me angry was that I hadn't known beforehand.
Well, did your daughter know what masturbating meant?
Well, she was listening to the record with her friend, and I think that yes, they understood what that meant. The issue is not what I think or what she thinks of quote unquote, those kinds of issues. What this meant to me and why I cite it was that was the first indication I'd had that the lyrics had indeed taken a very graphic turn.
And you were upset about that. So what did you
mainly
make rules
because,
in your house about rock records after that?
Well, we talked about it. I mean, I put the record on a higher shelf. She also has younger sisters. We talked about it. I advocate communication between parents and children, particularly about sexuality. The point is a subtle one, but I would not have particularly bought that album for her at that age had I known it was that explicit. I think that is individual parenting rights, and other people might feel very, very differently.
So let's talk about the kind of rules you created in your house after you realized that rock lyrics had become much more sexually explicit than they used to be. You started putting that on the top shelf. What else did you do?
Well, also violent. I mean, probably what disturbs me more than anything is the glorification of violence in the lyrics, the degradation of women. In looking into this, I saw some videos by groups that were very popular with young teens. They show scantily clad women rounded up with men with whips put into cages. It obviously has sexual overtones that are menacing. I mean, David Lee Roth has said that sadomasochism is something that's commercialized to teens now, and in some cases, preteens.
But I want to hear what you did in your house.
In my house, we discussed it. I sat down and watched MTV with my children. I was allowing them to watch it at will. Ironically, I would be monitoring the television shows they saw. I didn't want them to see too much violence on primetime TV. I've been concerned about that for years. I didn't know I needed to monitor the music. And in addition to many innovative, creative videos, there were also some that had very graphic splices of violence thrown up there very rapidly and some explicitly sexual images. Now, my children then were 6, 8, and 11. So I said, well, you can't just watch this all the time. Now I'm going to watch it with you. We're going to talk about it. I really didn't want them to see. Some of the images did frighten them, quite frankly. And it's no different than what they might see in a TV show or a movie.
Now, what are the groups that you found to be the most offensive in rock music?
Well, again, it's not that I have a particular list and I want to say, look, I think these are good and I think these are bad. I really am trying to alert people to tune in to the music, to the entertainment that their children are attracted to, and use it as a tool to communicate with the child. Listen to the child. Why does the child like this? Are there things in here that the parent should be concerned about? It's not up for me to say. What I advocate is information, people being more tuned in, and information from the record company so people can make up their own minds, and that's going to vary.
You know, I, like you, grew up with rock and roll, and I don't remember rock and roll ever being a tool for communicating between parents and children. It was, in my household, it was just the opposite. When the kids wanted to get away from the parents, that's where rock and roll came in. It was never something to, like, you know, bridge the gap or to sit down and discuss.
But you didn't have the kinds of themes in the rock and roll then that you have now. There weren't songs about sadism, about thrill killing, about suicide, about raping a woman, about forcing a woman sexually, about forcing oral sex on a young woman by a group that's very popular with preteens and young adolescents that has sold 2 million copies. I mean, this is a very graphic change, and that's why I think that parents really need to tune in today. It has changed, and while there's tremendous, just fun songs, there are these that are mixed in that maybe parents ought to be aware of.
It's true that the lyrics weren't nearly as explicit, 10, 20, 25 years ago. But on the other hand, people were as frightened by rock and roll. For instance, you know, when Elvis Presley was on the Ed Sullivan Show, the camera wasn't allowed to show his gyrating pelvis. When the Beatles and the Rolling Stones came to America, parents were in an uproar that their children were going to be corrupted and perverted by these, you know, shaggy-haired, strange people from another country who are singing rock and roll.
I think there's a big difference between Elvis's swiveling hips and a chainsaw blade between the thighs of Blackie Lawless, lead singer of a group called Wasp. The fact that they use a half-naked woman chained to a torture rack and they pretend to slit her throat in concert act, I'd say that is a qualitative difference. And I think parents ought to be tuned in. There's a group called Lizzie Borden. Their stage act consists of a very erotically clad woman. They try to kiss her. She rebuffs them. Their answer is to hack her to death with an axe. Of course, this is simulated. Then they spit out the blood. I mean, this is very, very different fare. It's not that I think rock and roll music is going to bring down the Republic. I'm not frightened about it. I personally am outraged by an exploitation of preteens and young teenagers by companies that are marketing the bottom line of explicit sex and violence. I call it cultural strip mining. They don't ask, what is the impact? What are the scars? How are some of the kids coping with this? They take the money and they run. It's a commercial enterprise. It's backed with advertising by executives strategically planning and thinking. And who's the audience? Younger and younger kids.
Now, you are working not only as an individual mother in your family, but you've co-organized a group called the Parents Music Resource Center that's petitioning for several things, including the labeling of records so that if there's sexually explicit or violently explicit material in the lyrics, it would be so labeled. You want to have all the lyrics available to a consumer before they purchase the record, and you also want to create a panel to set up policy guidelines for records.
No. Okay, the last is wrong. You've got it pretty well right, and there was a lot of publicity as our group debated and talked with the recording industry. First of all, 20 companies in the recording industry did agree to put a parental warning label that says explicit lyrics, parental advisory on the back of albums, or print the lyrics. They make the decision when they're you've got that right. That's correct. There's no panel. They make the decision. It's an issue of corporate responsibility. Also, the Parents Music Resource Center is in a coalition with the National PTA and the American Academy of Pediatrics. Both groups are, of course, oriented to child welfare. And also, they're interested in consumer information and creating awareness about the changes in some of today's entertainment medium.
For whose benefit are the warning labels?
The parents.
When do parents, I just don't know of a lot of parents who do the rock and roll shopping for their teenagers.
Well, I do. A lot of people still take their children to record stores if their children can't drive, if they don't live in the city.
Don't they kind of like drop them off, though?
Sure.
Let the children shop?
Some of them do, and some of them probably don't. I mean, I don't. Let me tell you how this issue originally came up, and even the concept of printing the lyrics, through the National PTA at their 1984 convention, which represented parents and teachers in every state in the union. And one of the resolutions they passed, because it was of such concern, was this one asking record companies to rate records. Now, later on, the agreement that we came up with the recording industry is not a record rating. It's just, a warning or putting the lyrics out there. The reason is, and we debated all this, is because we felt like we have a problem with the increasing explicitness and violence that's commercially marketed to younger and younger kids. And we're talking about even elementary-aged kids that are now tuned in. And we thought the only way in our free society to address it is by putting it on the table, so to speak, putting a little more light on it. We are not advocating censoring or banning or that it shouldn't be there. But in the words of Thomas Jefferson, the way to address excesses in free speech is through more speech, hence print the lyrics. Bring it out to the light of day. Hopefully you'd teach older kids to make their own decisions, maybe based on this kind of information.
There's something very potentially ironic about printing explicit lyrics and making them available before you've even purchased the record. We all know that in so many rock and roll songs, and this is historically true in rock and roll, you can't make out the lyrics. You know, one of the things parents used to traditionally complain about is, I don't know how you can listen to those songs. Who can understand the lyrics? So isn't it almost counterproductive for you to have the lyrics written out?
Well, I don't think so. I would ask your listeners to think about the song they just heard. I think the lyrics were very distinct.
But Prince isn't into heavy metal. I mean, it's different than the typical song that you're worried about.
Well, I would also like to point out that now many of the songs, particularly heavy metal songs, have accompanying videos with very powerful images. And it's easy for a young child to go right from Sesame Street to tune in to MTV or the broadcast channels of rock videos. Very powerful images. And in some cases, they even change the interpretation of a song. They seem to be using the sex and violence to sell, where if you just heard the song, you might interpret it differently yourself.
You've used the example that you want to fight some speech with more speech, and by printing the lyrics and having warning labels on. In the record industry, it's being largely perceived as having a chilling effect, that would have a chilling effect on speech within music.
Why did the record industry agree to this voluntary program?
Then? Because of all the pressure being put on them, I think. Isn't that what they've said? Isn't that what the spokespeople have said?
Their official statement is that it's a legitimate consumer complaint. They probably pulled out their files from a couple years ago when the National PTA was writing to them, trying to get them to address this issue.
A friend of mine is fond of saying that the ratings in movies nowadays exist more for parents than for younger people. And I think that this is true of people of our generation, for instance. We're both in our 30s, yes?
Yes.
And I know people of my age, when we take our parents to see to the movies, we wonder, is there going to be language in this film that will be offensive to them? Will Will my parents be offended if there's a sex scene in the movie? And so a lot of people think that the ratings nowadays are for people in their 60s and 70s more so than for younger people or for even teenagers. Do you know what I'm saying? That every generation seems to have a different standard of what is acceptable and what is really offensive.
And that's exactly what this whole discussion is about, is what are the limits in the public domain, particularly where children are concerned. And I think they've changed. Could I just talk a little bit about concert performances?
Sure.
I don't want to stay on music entirely because the book is about, you know, TV and movies and with particular emphasis on violence. But in the context of people not knowing, the average age of a fan of a group, particularly of a group like the Beastie Boys, according to them in Newsweek magazine, are 13-year-old girls. And what do they do in their concert act? Well, I quote from the Washington Post, quote, "This band performed sexual acts on stage at a recent concert in Columbus, Ohio. The members of this rock band reportedly took turns kissing the naked breast of the crafty girl in the cage, a bikini-clad girl dancing in a cage." It goes on, their lyrics refer to angel dust and crack with lines like, "I trust that crack." In Memphis, the Beastie Boys used a giant inflatable penis during their song "Fight for Your Right" in Columbus, Georgia. They invited girls from the audience to bare their breasts and have sex with members of their road crew. It goes on. My point is, people ought to be informed in the public domain if an act is going to be this explicit. We're going to vary in our personal opinions as to whether this is acceptable or not. But there were kids 7, 8, 9 in the audience for this act whose parents were outraged because they weren't informed beforehand.
I want to talk more about this in a second. We're going to take a short break. My guest is Tipper Gore. She's co-founder of the Parents Music Resource Center. We'll be back in a second. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Tipper Gore. She co-founded the Parents Music Resource Center, whose goal is to alert parents to music with explicit sexual or violent lyrics. She wants the music industry to put warning labels on such records. Tipper Gore has written a new book titled Raising PG Kids in an X-Rated Society. Now, you were just talking about the stage acts that a lot of rock groups have.
That some of them have.
Now, some of the heavy metal and punk groups are really into irony, and with some of them, it's hard to tell whether you should be taking something at face value or taking them on an ironic level.
Well, something like I just read. Is that ironic, what I just read?
With the Beastie Boys, I'd say there's a good chance what they were doing had an ironic level to it.
Yeah, but I mean, going over and kissing the naked breast of the girl in the cage, lyrics about crack, I mean, a giant inflatable penis. I mean, where's the irony? There could be irony for older people, but can a 9-year-old, can a 7-year-old, you know, are they going to pick up on that?
You know what I'm wondering? You know how rock and roll has always had a certain shock value and also has been about rebellion? You know how rock and roll has always been associated with rebellion for children?
Sure.
And for teenagers?
Sure.
Do you think that your attempts to crack down in a way?
No, I simply want to make parents aware.
Okay, but you want parents to
do whatever they feel is appropriate in their own homes with their kids.
Okay, and do you think that is in its own way creating a backlash of even more explicit and violent and just really flamboyant stage acts and lyrics in defiance of the kind of work your group is doing?
This kind of thing has been happening, and I'd like to point to the fact that it's that it really is kind of cultural strip mining. These are marketing decisions, okay? Look, here is an ad which is described in the book. I know your listeners can't see it, but it's an ad from movie producers to television programmers in something called electronic media. The general public is not going to see it. But what do they say? Boost the ratings with your teen viewers with these 16 exploitation films. Exploitation films, that's explicit sex and violence. I mean, it's a marketing decision. So that's why we're seeing so much of it. I mean, it gets into a kind of competitive titillation. But again, I think the issue is, what is the sensitivity to younger kids in these audiences? It's up to parents to set rules, make guidelines, talk with their kids and talk about these issues. But I think parents have not been particularly tuned in to the changes, like I wasn't, because I didn't have to worry about this. This stuff wasn't this graphic when I was growing up.
How do your children feel about your activism?
I hope it sets a good example for them. I mean, I want the message to be, we are responsible for the society we're creating. You are responsible, no matter what issue it is you want to get involved in, whether it's, you know, raising awareness about the homeless or child abuse or whatever it is, take action on your beliefs.
I guess I want to know if they resent the amount of control you want to exert, or if they're, I guess I'd even like to know if their friends, if their peers make fun of them at all, because you're in such, because you're in the limelight, and because you're asking parents to monitor their children. It's not something that teenagers usually go for.
Of course not. I mean, teenagers are always testing the limit, and a rebellion is a natural stage of development, and it's a natural part, as you say, of rock and roll and other things. I'm talking about exploitation to the excess, what I think is, and I'm trying to tell people, make up your own minds about it, but at least take a good look at it, because it's a subculture that's developed to the kids. And basically, adults are on their own wavelength. They're listening to their own music. They've been through this. And I think they make the mistake of figuring their kids can handle all this without any kind of input from them. So what I'm trying to say is take a look at it. My kids have handled it very well, to answer your question. I mean, they understand why I'm doing what I'm doing. I am fairly flexible. I am not this inflexible person that perhaps I appear to be.
What do you do when they want to go to a concert? Say they want to go to the Beastie Boys concert. What are you going to tell them?
I fortunately have really not had to deal with that yet, because my child is just 13. But I say that what parents ought to do is take a good look at these groups, find out what kind of stage acts they perform. Find out what kind of lyrics. Make your own decision if you think it's appropriate or not for your young child. That's my message. It's not that I'm trying to say this group is good, this group is bad, you shouldn't let your kids go, or you should. I think that's up to the individual parents and the kids. What I am saying is, look how graphically some of the content has changed, and get involved and make some of those decisions and help your kids make them.
What's the toughest thing that's happened in your family with your children? In terms of them wanting to play a record or read a book or see a movie, you know, that you didn't want them to do?
Oh, I think just sort of the constant having to monitor things and look into things. If my child wants to see a movie and it's R-rated, we have a general rule, no R-rated movies, with the exception that sometimes we'll make exceptions. And I've even taken my oldest to an R-rated movie when it was just for language, and I knew she could handle that. So, you see, she knows that I'm flexible. She knows how I feel, but she also knows that I'm inflexible. So we talk about each thing. I also know that she's probably going to see some at a friend's house, etc. But at least there's a value put on violence. I mean, she thinks about it and the degradation of women. And it's not that I think that I'm going to protect her from this forever or control it down to the nth degree. It's just that I think what we've had up till now is a society that says, if it feels good, do it. If you want it, grab it. They don't think about the consequences. I think that's a little unhealthy for the kids. It's like, it's better to give them a rule to break than no rule at all.
You've been on a lot of panels, mm-hmm. with people, with musicians from the rock world, mm-hmm. Including Frank Zappa, who's been, I think, on a lot of panels with you.
Right.
What are those like for you? Here you are with people who are from the kind of type of music that you oppose. What's your reaction been like?
Well, it's always been very stimulating and very interesting. I think sometimes it's been unfair in that they have continued to say, oh, this woman wants to ban rock and roll. And I keep saying, look, I don't. Not at all. I like it. It's just awareness.
You complain in your book that you think some of the musicians treat you in a sexist way, in a way they talk to you.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that perhaps they're not aware. I mean, one of the things I talk about is the degradation of women, the brutalization of women in some of the images, in some of the lyrics, in some of the promotional pictures, etc., trying to get people to think about it. Men have never been particularly sexually discriminated against. It's perhaps hard for them to understand why it's upsetting to women to see this kind of attitude continue to be glamorized and promoted to another generation of kids.
You don't like being called like a group of housewives or a group of senators' wives?
Well, names don't bother me. I learned early on, you know, don't worry about what names people call you. Try to focus on the issues. What I'm more concerned about is the sexist way women are portrayed as sex objects, as victims, even in television. Television right now has a violence at an all-time high, with women usually portrayed as the victims. It's the same that you find in the music. This is from George Gribner, the University of Pennsylvania, who's tracked this. I mean, is this the kind of attitude we want to continue perpetrating in our society?
Your husband, who is Senator Albuquerque, recently announced his candidacy for the presidential Democratic nomination. Say he was elected. Would you, as First Lady, make this a big campaign nationally?
That's an interesting question. Most people don't realize how many issues I'm involved in. I'm on the board of an Alzheimer's daycare center. I'm on the board of the National Mental Health Association. I would like to draw attention to mental health. I'm working on a project to document homelessness in America that I started 2 years ago that I'm very excited about. I think we need to tackle the problem of homelessness.
Yeah, but would
in
you
this
continue
country.
This stuff?
It's
you don't know.
I'm not trying to dodge it. I'm trying to say that that position gives you a platform to focus on a lot of extremely important issues and problems in our nation. And I don't know what I would want to focus on, but there are many other things that I'm already involved in.
It's interesting. When I was reading your book, you print a lot of the most explicit lyrics in songs, and you reproduce photographs from some of the most graphic album covers and also very graphically violent or sexual shots from certain teen movies. And then I noticed on the cover of your book, there's an advisory. It says, warning, explicit material, parental advisory. Mm-hmm. Do you think parents who are reading your book should hide it from their children?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that's up to the parent in their home to decide. They may want to talk about it. It depends on the age of the child, the involvement that the child has in the media. My whole point is, look, this is aimed at parents and adults. Most of the material that I talk about in here is the material that is aimed and marketed at the kids. The point being, the kids know all about this already. It's basically the parents that are not aware, and I'm trying to get them to focus. As to what they do in their own home, that's up to them.
Have your children read your book?
No, they have not.
I think a lot of our listeners would be interested in hearing what kind of music you grew up with.
I think I was 14 years old when the Beatles hit. I was too young, really, for Elvis Presley. I went crazy over the Beatles and the Dave Clark Five, the British Invasion, all of that music, Bob Dylan, folk music, Peter, Paul, and Mary. What I remember most about the music is it made you feel positive. It made you feel
Dylan
like
made you feel positive?
Well, what I mean in general about the music of the 60s, it was more message music that mm-hmm. made you feel like you were part of a larger whole and that you could do something about problems. You know what I'm saying?
Did your parents ever warn you away from the music?
They didn't have to.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't think there wasn't the explicit sex or violence in the music that would have disturbed them. If they had a look at the kind of scene that's available today, in addition to all the good music that's out there, they might have warned me, yes. So it wasn't necessary then.
You never warned by parents or teachers about rock and roll? Did you ever?
Oh, no. Why would I? I mean, rock and roll, look, rock and roll is mainstream American music right now. But there's a part of it that's just being commercially exploited to kids, just like in other areas, whether it's TV or movies or some of the ads.
You're going to be stepping up your campaign against the music industry, you know, to have them label lyrics.
Actually,
what's the next step for your group?
Let me just say, the campaign, again, it's not really, I don't like to characterize a campaign against the music industry. It's a dialogue with the music industry.
We only have a couple of seconds.
Okay. They've agreed to voluntarily put lyrics on.
Okay.
That's great. It's a start. That's all. That's what we asked.
Tipper Gore, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Tipper Gore. She's co-founder of the Parents Music Resource Center. She's written a new book. It's titled Raising PG Kids in an X-Rated Society. Her husband, Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee, recently declared his candidacy for the Democratic presidential nomination. This is Fresh Air. On tomorrow's edition of Fresh Air, I'll speak with Erica Jong, who's written a new novel, so I hope you can join us. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funds come from NPR member stations and the listeners to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶ This is a closed circuit feed, not for broadcast. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with South African novelist Nadine Gordimer. Her latest book, A Sport of Nature, follows a white South African woman coming of age in the days nearing the end of white rule. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Don't Let Me Down, David Bowie's new album. Film critic Stephen Schiff says all those movie reviewers on TV are changing the way we watch films. And we'll have the latest news from National Public Radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Time for the news. This is Fresh Air. David Bowie has a new album out. It's called Never Let Me Down. Our rock critic Ken Tucker says Bowie the chameleon has once again changed his color. Here's the opening from a song from the album. It's called Day In, Day Out.
David Bowie has breathlessly confessed to his diary, otherwise known as Rolling Stone magazine, that his new album, Never Let Me Down, quote, includes every style I've ever played in, unquote. Since this album is surprisingly good, surprising because so much of his recent work as both musician and actor has been so mediocre, I thought we could listen to one of his new songs and then have a little chat about this English rocker's changeability. This is the title song from David Bowie's new album, Never Let Me Down.
Jacked in a high dollar joint, son.
That's Never Let Me Down, a good example of Bowie at his most effective, stealing up-to-the-minute rhythm and blues riffs and making them into slinky pop music. That song is pleasant but lightweight, as is Bowie's entire canon. His importance in the history of rock is that his prominence has less to do with his music than with his presence. He's made an art out of image. Never Let Me Down is Bowie's 17th album, unusual enough in the here-today and gone-tomorrow world of pop. Bowie is like the Christmas fruitcake that keeps reappearing every year. He's 40 now, but like his pal Mick Jagger, he likes to jump around in tight leather to convince you that he still feels young. In the early 70s, it was Bowie who made glitter rock a pop phenomenon with his languid cross-dressing and the tart hard rock of his first alter ego, Ziggy Stardust. When disco was all the rage, Bowie assumed the character of the Thin White Duke and actually got a good album out of it, Station to Station, in 1976. Bowie has been resourceful about maintaining his visibility. When his recording career slumped in the early 80s, he pretended to be a movie star in bombs like Just a Gigolo and The Hunger. He even played the Elephant Man on Broadway, although when he took off his shirt, the play became the Chicken Man. Perhaps the most interesting persona Bowie has adopted was the one he was pushing just a few years ago, around the time of his album Let's Dance. He did a slew of interviews proclaiming that he was, oh, the horror, an ordinary guy, a single father, a hard worker. With the release of Never Let Me Down, Bowie is now offering himself as the aging but plucky rock legend, eager to prove he can still attract a crowd. As usual, he's got the media figured out. Rolling Stone just noted with undisguised admiration that the former decadent now lifts weights and works out. David Bowie will commence a U.S. tour in June. Be prepared for this latest persona, the British yuppie with muscles.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Listening to Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is white South African novelist Nadine Gordimer. She continues to live and work in South Africa, despite the fact that three of her novels were at one time banned by her country's government. Her stories began to appear here in the 1950s, and she became known for her portraits of ordinary people caught up in the drama and contradictions of the times they lived in. Her latest novel is called A Sport of Nature. It's about the present and future of South Africa as seen through the life of a white South African Jewish girl named Helela. Helela's life revolves around the men that she knows and later marries, including a black revolutionary leader. I asked Nadine Gordimer if she expresses her own opposition to apartheid through her writing.
Not at all. When I'm writing novels or stories, I'm doing my work, the thing that I'm best fitted to do. I wouldn't ever put such ability as I have as an artist at the service of any cause, however much I personally felt attached to it. That would be writing propaganda. I'm not a propagandist. But in my private life as an individual, it is there that I support very strongly the cause of liberation in South Africa, in my actions and in my words as a private person.
Do you think that your books have contributed to the cause?
I would like to think so, from the point of view that they inform people outside at a depth at which the media, news media, cannot, of how laws actually shape people's lives and their emotions, what these laws do to people when they live in such a, under such a regime. And I think this is true of all writers, all imaginative writers who live under some kind of oppression. It fleshes out the facts for the rest of the outside world, and I think also helps the people within the country to understand what has been done with them, what they have become, to understand their own reactions and begin to have doubts. And I think doubt is a very healthy thing for people to feel, begin to question yourself.
The main character in your book is Jewish, and your father was a Jew who fled Tsarist Lithuania. And it's ironic that he fled oppression and then moved to a country where he would end up being identified as an oppressor by virtue of his skin color. Was that an irony that you felt growing up?
No, I didn't feel that at all when I was growing up, but I certainly feel it now. Of course it is an irony, very much so.
Does it make it any easier to be accepted and trusted in black revolutionary circles if you're not an Afrikaner?
Yes, I think it does. Though even if you're not an Afrikaner, you still have to prove by word and deed that you really do identify with the liberation cause. It's not enough just to say, you know, I'm with you. You've got to show that you really are. And there are Afrikaners who've done this too.
Was there a turning point in your life where you decided to side with the revolutionary struggle?
I think it's been a slow process. I was born in that small town, a little mining town near Johannesburg. I lived the ordinary life of any white child, totally cut off from black people except insofar as they were around doing menial jobs. And then when I moved to Johannesburg as a young writer, I moved in the sort of set that you find everywhere. I think that the people in the arts are freer of prejudice than other people because they're all breaking all sorts of other conventions as well. So then I began to move freely with blacks and found that with some of them I had far more in common than I had with whites. In other words, we had community of interest in writing or in another form of the arts, and so friendships were formed. Then when I moved to Johannesburg in the 1950s, it was the time of the big passive resistance campaigns. I could have taken part in them, but I didn't. I think I was a slow developer. I was looking on from the outside. I felt very sympathetic and supportive, but I didn't go there to the sit-ins. I didn't get myself involved in that way. And the act of involvement came latterly as I got to know and saw more and more deeply what was happening in the country and the extent of the oppression. So I became more involved.
Has the government ever offered you any kind of deals, for instance, that if you didn't associate publicly with black revolutionaries, that they wouldn't ban your books?
No, I'm afraid not. I don't think they regard writers as important enough to make that sort of deal.
The way you've described the writer's importance in South Africa, it sounds like writers, as far as the government is concerned, is more of a thorn in their side than any real threat.
Exactly.
Well, why is that so?
Well, where would the writers represent a threat? Have they ever represented a threat in your own country, in England?
Well,
no.
In America, writers complain that they're not taken seriously enough.
Well, I think that is the whole point, that governments don't take writers seriously. And the effect that writers have on the public is, as I've said, a slow business. But it often goes very deep. But I think governments don't see this. They don't take much notice of writers. I think the French are the only people who've ever felt that writers were worth listening to and even made some of their poets diplomats at a certain time. But it certainly isn't general anywhere else in the English-speaking world that I know of.
Why do you stay in Johannesburg? What keeps you in South Africa?
It's my home. I was born there. I'm deeply attached to it. It's my place in life.
Your new novel concludes with, if you don't mind me giving this away, a black majority rule in South Africa. If that were to happen in your lifetime, as I know you hope that it does, how do you think your own life would be changed by it?
I would hope that many things that distress me in my own life, some of the conditions under which I must live, I'm talking about the white privileges, the fact that everything is decided by whites. I hope that will all change. I would like to see that very much.
So the privilege of the white person is a burden to you?
Yes, much of it has become a burden. Because, first of all, one goes through the stage of feeling ashamed of it. There's nothing much you can do, and if you do it on a personal level, the laws remain the same. In my life, I've come to realize that, right, your own personal behavior is important, of course, toward other people. But in the end, it's the framework within which you live that counts. And that framework has been so rigid all my life that my personal defiances of it really count for very little. And what you need is to change the laws, change the social order.
What have those personal defiances been?
Well, I mean, in the 50s, I moved in a set that had strong social relations with blacks. We went in and out of black townships. We had, at that time, you were forbidden to have blacks in your house. You couldn't drink together. But we did all this, and we felt very defiant and brave. But we were not really very brave. We didn't achieve very much. We made some personal relationships that have lasted. But when we parted after the party, so to speak, the blacks went home to their black ghettos, and we went to our pleasant homes in the suburbs. That's the kind of thing that I mean.
Are there small defiances that you continue to take on now in your day-to-day life?
Some small and some a little bigger.
What are the big ones?
Well, I wouldn't really like to talk about them because
there
are things that one does that are really not for to be broadcast.
I understand.
Otherwise, one couldn't go on doing them.
You know, it's interesting. The main character in your book, Halela, has the kind of influence that she has in part because of the men who she's chosen to marry or be lovers with.
She's a kind of courtesan, really, of a new kind, of a modern kind.
Yeah, of a kind of revolutionary sort.
Yes, but if you look back in history, you know, you have Madame de Maintenon, people like that. You even have, think of Evita Peron. I see Halela somewhat in that mold, though I like her rather better.
I wonder if you see yourself as a feminist.
No, not really. I'm a feminist insofar as I'm a humanist. I think that everybody, no matter what sex, color, creed, should have exactly the same rights.
Let me just thank you. Thank you very much for talking with us today, Nadine Gordimer.
Bye-bye.
Nadine Gordimer's new novel is called A Sport of Nature. She spoke with us from New York. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
It's the third day of the Iran-Contra hearings. How are you following them tonight?
Well, we'll have another report on the hearings themselves on General Secord's testimony. It's been getting a little bit tougher in there today between Secord and Arthur Lyman, the counsel, and also President Reagan as a disputed Secord's version of the conversation that Oliver North said he had with the president about the irony of Ayatollahs paying for Contra's weapons.
Are you continuing coverage of the Gary Hart story?
For sure, and we'll be asking the old reliable Political Observer whether Senator Hart is finished. This one says he is.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Gene Shalit used to have a virtual monopoly on television film reviews, but in the last few years, we've seen a proliferation of movie reviewers on TV, including programs featuring dueling film critics. Our film critic, Stephen Schiff, thinks that movie review shows on TV are changing the way that we look at movies.
Something has changed, I'm afraid, in the relations between smart people and film critics. More and more, smart people are getting their film criticism from TV. They know that some of these televised critics have exactly two qualifications for their job. One, the ability to make any film title into a pun, and two, a remarkable mustache. But nobody takes those critics very seriously. Instead, smart people are tuning into the Gene and Roger show. Its current incarnation is called Siskel and Ebert in the movies. Now, I'm personally fond of Gene and Roger, and I congratulate them on inventing a diabolical new form of entertainment. But there's a danger here. A lot of people watching their television show may think that they're watching film criticism. In fact, film criticism's finest flower. And when people begin to adopt the Gene and Roger way of looking at movies, they believe they're getting to a film's essence when they leave the theater saying either, "I laughed, I cried," or else, "You know, I really cared about that horse." Gene and Rogerism is reasoned and seemingly analytical. It gives us the illusion that we're doing what film critics do, that is, monitoring our responses. And so it leaves us open to the basest forms of manipulation Hollywood can come up with. "I cried. I really cared about that horse." If we're to foster any hopes for the cinema's producing works worthy of its potential, we, the audience, have to realize that even the most minimally competent manipulator of film can make us cry or care. I mean, "reach out and touch someone" ads bring a tear to my eye. If I could demolish any popular notion about the movies, I think I would dynamite the idea that if you're watching a picture and something in it brings tears to your eyes, that picture must be pretty terrific. To me, tearjerkers are the soulless Don Juans of the cinema. They profess sincerity during the seduction and then steal away. At the heart of the tearjerker lies a monstrous insensitivity. After all, movies do open us up and make us feel vulnerable. That light dances on the screen and summons our emotions to the surface, where the wispiest breeze will send a ripple through them. Don Juans know how to work those emotions. Their methods are as routine as a tonsillectomy. They know that children and puppies and big hugs can draw dew from even the driest eyes. It's almost Pavlovian. There's nothing wrong with succumbing, of course. We all want to. But what bugs me is the way tearjerkers pass off the most egregious manipulations as art. When movies like On Golden Pond or Project X are taken seriously, their cool calculation becomes a form of brutality. They catch us with our guard down and bludgeon us into feeling, and then into a kind of innocent gratitude for what we've felt. "I felt something," we burble. "I really cared about that horse." If you leave a movie like On Golden Pond wet-eyed, well, you're no different from Gene or Roger or anybody else. But if you leave thinking you've just seen a great movie, you've been had.
Our film critic Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's what's coming up on the next edition of Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with film director Stephen Frears. He's best known for My Beautiful Laundrette. His new film, Prick Up Your Ears, is about the life and death of gay British playwright Joe Orton. Critic at large Laurie Stone will review two books that examine mother-daughter relationships. And accordionist William Schimmel of the Tango Project will show off the instrument that everyone makes fun of. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY-FM Philadelphia.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistant is Ed Doherty. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.